Yeah, Cohen, welcome to the podcast, man.
Yeah, thanks. Great to be here.
Awesome. It's the first time in a while I've done this not over Zoom, so things have changed. Okay, so we're talking about eel today, but first I had a few questions for international listeners. What and who is Fish and Game?
Yeah, so Fish and Game is a statutory body here in New Zealand responsible for the management of game birds and sports fish.
Yeah.
And when I say game birds, I'm meaning birds, some of our waterfowl and introduced mallard, for example. We've got paradise shelduck, which are native game bird, shoveler and black swan, also both natives. We've got upland game as well, so that's like some pheasants and quail.
Yeah.
And when I say sports fish, the primary sports fish in New Zealand, brown trout and rainbow trout, and we also have populations of Chinook salmon as well.
Yeah, which is a species I have not had the privilege of going after, so that's cool. Okay, and so you enhance habitat, you protect habitat, like...
Yeah, so Fish and Game's involved in a variety of activities, really, and habitat advocacy is probably one of our main areas, advocating for the maintenance and improvement of habitat. Also involved in all manner of other things, so monitoring of those species, obviously, research as well, education, and you're just enhancing participation in those recreational pursuits as well.
Yeah, that's cool. Like Fish and Game has made my life super easy. You know, you can go on some of those apps, and all of the Fish and Game river access points are marked, and it's just cool. Like, just from that perspective, like from someone does this recreationally, like you just make life easy, and then all this massive background work that a lot of people just are not aware. So you, like, where are you from? Are you Invercargill born and bred?
Not born and bred, literally from Auckland in the North Island of New Zealand.
Yeah.
And yeah, city, very much a city environment. And then yeah, fortunately my folks decided to make the big move all the way down to the bottom of the South Island. And it didn't take me long to find the great hunting and fishing that Southland has to offer. And
oh, yeah.
Spent many of my school holidays as a youngster on my push bike, biking down to the local river. And got pretty passionate about fishing there through my teen years. And that probably actually spurred me on to my studies at the University of Otago, where I studied ecology.
Yeah.
And went on to do an MSc in ecology as well. And yeah, after my thesis, it was quite fortuitous, a job came up at Fish and Game, and I had previously done some holiday work through the university break with Fish and Game, so I thought, oh yeah, this would be a pretty good fit, so I applied for the job and was fortunate enough to get it, so that's sort of how I ended up at Fish and Game.
Did you think when you started studying, like, I want to go for Fish and Game, or did you not have an idea of where you wanted to end up?
No, Fish and Game wasn't really on my radar. I sort of more studied marine science and aquaculture, so I thought I'd always get into that sort of field, but... yeah, and the job came up and thought, why not give it a nudge and see how we go.
When you fished as a kid, was that like spin fishing in rivers, or was it fly, or like what was it?
Yeah, so I started off very humbly with drowning some worms for trout in the local river, and then got into the spin fishing, and then it was probably in my late teens, of course, the gradual progression to fly fishing, got into that, and now I'll use any method to catch a trout. I'm not fussy.
Yeah, like agnostic.
Yeah, exactly. Whatever works, I'll use it. In fact, I think it's great to mix it up. I mean, I love, using a live bully as bait, for example, to try and catch a trout. And then there's also that beautiful thing of seeing a brown trout come up and take a dry fly. There's nothing quite like it.
Yeah, man, the moment season opens, my life becomes much better every year. So if your boss tells you today, like, you've got the day off, let's say it was sunny, like, what are you going to do? Like, are you going to go fly fish? Like what's your, like, you've got a day off?
Well, for me, because I'm doing fishing and the game bird hunting side of things for a job, I'll probably do something slightly different. I'm a pretty keen deer stalker. I particularly like hunting over an indicating dog in the New Zealand bush.
Oh, awesome.
So that's the pinnacle for me at the moment. Yeah, getting in.
Have you got an indicating dog?
Yes, I do, yeah.
What dog is it?
A German Shorthaired Pointer.
Oh, yeah, cool. I'm interviewing Tim Gale from the Game Animal Council on Monday, and I think he also has an indicating dog that's a Shorthaired Pointer.
Yeah. So like dry fly fishing is to trout fishing.
Yeah.
Hunting in the bush over an indicating dog is... to hunting. Like, I think it's the absolute pinnacle, up close and personal. You can basically see their eyelashes, I say. You know, it's so close.
Wow. Yeah, we were in a spot, I forgot the name now, one of the close spots that everybody knows about, but yeah, I don't know why it escapes me now. And we spooked a deer that was bedded down and was no more than 10 meters from us. If we had a dog, life would have been, you know, we would have known it's there.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm going to the Gandog trials in 2 weekends, I think. Yeah. Southland trial, so I'm pretty keen to actually get a Gandog or something like that. So yeah.
Well, worth it. I wouldn't be without one now.
Oh yeah, really? Yeah. That's cool. But anyways, we're here to talk about basically eel study. So I read the eel study that you did, and but there's like, how did it come about? There's like a funny thing with a farmer, like. Yeah. Wanting you to come check a pond.
That's right. It was kind of funny how it all started, this particular line of work. And yeah, we just got contacted by a farmer who we actually done some work on his property as part of a larger research project that we're working on, looking at mallard productivity in Southland. And anyway, he got in touch with us and said, look, I'm worried about the ducklings on my pond getting eaten by eels.
Yeah.
There's heaps of them in here. So it's either you guys come and remove them, or I'm going to get a commercial eel fisherman in there to remove them.
Yeah.
So I thought, oh, well, we better go and do him a favour, particularly since he let us do some work on his property for our research. And, yeah, we put half a dozen fight nets or something into the pond and, yeah, just left them overnight, came back the following morning, and, yeah, by goodness, those fight nets were full to the brim with eels. And, yeah, I suppose that really started the thought processes there. By goodness, this is just one pond in Southland. We've got literally thousands of ponds, duck hunting ponds across Southland. So maybe we're onto something here. We need to start investigating this more. These duck hunting ponds aren't just places to shoot ducks. They're also important habitat for some of our native fish species.
So for someone who's never heard of a duck pond, what is it? Like one that's, specifically a duck pond, yeah.
Well, they sort of range in their qualities, I suppose, in terms of they could be what we call a dig-out job, where a farmer's literally gone and got the digger and dug a hole and a depression in his paddock and let it fill with water. And there's some of the more crude ones, but then you can actually get some where guys put some real serious effort, really trying to make them look as natural as possible, putting huge amounts of effort into the planting around that wetland, and you're making sure that it's in your tip-top shape and really going to encourage waterfowl for them.
Yeah, not like some sludgy, like a proper piece of wetland. Really.
Yeah, looks more like a wetland than a duck pond.
Than a duck pond. Okay, yeah. We'll talk later about your idea of duck ponds and the connotation. Fike net, just explain a fike net to people who've never heard of it.
Yeah, so fike net is basically a big, large mesh net. It's got two traps within that net, and it's got a large wing of about 3 or so meters in length. And the eels basically will hit that wing and swim, be guided into that net by that wing. And once they get in past the traps, they're trapped in there. They can't get out.
But then they can still like move and breathe. And they're basically just in a net that's got a frame, right? So it's not like a closed, folded type thing. It's like it's open. And, and then you if you want to, you bait it, right, with cat food, as far as I understand.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, you can bait them. And we certainly did that in our particular study. But it's more reading since I've done since that, baiting is not really required during the summer months in particular. Eels are moving around a lot, and you don't need to bait them at all. They'll just incidentally swim into the wing
and then
into your net.
Remain trapped. Yeah. So now you've seen that there's eel in like a duck pond. What happened with, did you remove the eel for this guy? Like
we removed them, just relocated them to a small, I think it was a creek on his property. So to let them carry on their way. But probably what they did was carry on up a tile, drain and back into the pond.
That's what I think. They'll probably ride back there. Yeah. You'll notice it next year, next season, or when the ducklings disappear.
That's right.
And now, like, I mean, you go, okay, we need to start looking at this. What, like, how do you set parameters for the study? Like, what's the conversation after that in the office?
Yeah, so it was basically making sure that if we're going to do this study, that we're going to be covering all sorts of different shapes and sizes of ponds across the whole of Southland, if we want to get a whole big picture look at Southland, particularly because the two species of eel that we've got, the shortfin eel and the longfin eel, do have some different characteristics. For example, the short fin eel don't tend to penetrate as far inland as the long fin eel do. They'll penetrate right up into the high country quite easily, the long fin, whereas the short fin might only be around, you know, 100 or so metres in elevation from the coast. Yeah, that was a key thing for us to consider, to make sure we're getting a good spread across the landscape and lots of different sizes too, because, yeah, not all wetlands are the same size.
If you talk about, you're talking about wetland size, eel size, what are the biggest, the like a long fin and a short fin grow to?
Yeah, so easily up to a metre in length.
For both of them?
Yeah, for both of them.
Okay, yeah. Jeez, that's massive.
The long fin can get bigger. I've seen the odd photographs of some real stonkers. But yeah, I mean, the bulk of the eels that we would encounter would be up to about a metre in length, typically in between, you know, 500 to 700 millimetres. Yeah.
Okay. And then you identified, like, how do you identify duck ponds? Because how do you ask someone, can I come put a net in your pond? Like, okay, first, how do you identify the ponds?
Yeah, so I guess the thing was, we had to get access to these ponds. They're all on private land.
Yeah.
So we had to tap into our own contacts across the region.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was basically the best way to do it. And then, talk to one farmer and he says, oh, you can come and do my ponds. Oh, wait, I'll talk to my neighbour or my brother who's got another farm down at this spot, and you can go and do his one too. That's sort of how it happened, sort of a bit of a snowballing, really, which was quite good. So you tap into our own contacts, and I guess once we had sampled them, put them on a Google Earth sort of aerial imagery to make sure that we're covering the region pretty well, to make sure we've got ponds scattered all amongst the region. Yeah.
And how many ponds were in the study at the end?
So all up, we did surveys in 56 ponds.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then you said when we spoke a while back that when you looked on like maps or some satellite imagery, there were thousands of duck ponds.
Oh, yeah, that's exactly right. And actually, that was part of our study, to be able to quantify the number of eels and the biomass of eels in the south and duck ponds. Of course, we've got to know how many south and duck ponds are out there.
Yeah,
so that involved a lot of looking at satellite imagery, laying grid lines over that imagery, and then randomly selecting these quadrats across that grid line to be able to count the ponds, and then obtain an average, and then extrapolate that out across the Southland area.
How many do you, I mean, I don't know if that you've got that in kind of in the back of your head, but how many ponds do you think are there across Southland?
So our estimates, once we did exactly that, was around 7,000.
It's insane, and they're all hand, like, dug by someone. So
so they're all constructed wetlands, constructed for the purposes of primarily duck hunting.
That's crazy.
Yeah,
it shows you the passion in the region for duck hunting.
That's exactly right. I mean, I think you'd struggle to find a Southland farm without at least one duck pond.
Yeah,
and if you did find one without one duck pond, there'd be his neighbour that would have six to make up for it.
Yeah, you know? That's crazy. Yeah. We were in a spot once where the farmer said we can come jump shoot on a river. It was in Waikato. But then there was a massive duck pond on the farm next door. So the ducks all just favored, you know, the pond, and we had like zero success. How do you start to study? What do you do then? Like, do you go to all these ponds, and what do you do?
Yeah, so we had to do, in the first instance, what's called a full depletion survey on a select number of ponds, so we could figure out how many eels we were catching with each night of trapping to obtain our population estimate. So yeah, what we do is we put the net in the first night, in the first night, keep the catch from that night retained in some holding nets, put the nets out again the second night, retain that catch, third night, do it again, and what you get is maybe in the first night you might catch 30 eels in the pond, second night you might catch 20, last night you might catch 5. So what you've got, of course, is a depletion there.
Yeah.
And then from there we can do a bit of statistics and figure out if we were to continue doing that trapping forever when we'd eventually get down to zero.
To zero.
And have a population estimate.
And then you do that across a bunch of ponds, and that's how you figure it out. Yeah. And then so does that mean when you do the start going into all the ponds, you can do one night of catch, and then you can just that's all. You don't have to.
That's exactly right. So, so we figured out what the proportional catch that we were catching each night, and then from there we could just do single night traps. And we, I think it was around on the first, I think we caught around 50% on average of an estimated population.
Super interesting, eh?
Yeah. So then we could just do single night traps on the remainder of those ponds and know that we'd only captured 50% of what was there.
Do you think the eel just randomly swim into it, or do you think they're curious? Or is that, I mean, because eel are quite curious, right? Like, I've sat next to hikes and they kind of come up and check you out and then they go off. Yeah. Like, you can physically see they're coming to check you out. Do you think it's like, or is it like, I mean, you can only speculate, I guess.
Yeah, well, I mean, certainly that stinky cat food that's in that that net is going to spike their interest. There's no doubt about that.
And then, I mean, now you do this, over how long period did it take you? Because this is, it's a lot of driving. Yeah. It's a large area.
Yeah.
What's the lowest that you went and kind of like the highest that you went within Southland?
Yeah, so we did quite a few close to the coast around here near Invercargill.
Yeah.
So that wasn't much travel involved. But then, of course, we had to do somewhere we travelled right up to around Tiano as well,
yeah,
which is pretty far inland there.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and this was all done over a summer period. It was pretty important to do this sampling over the summer because that is where you've got the eels moving around the most. So through that winter period, they almost become dormant.
Yeah.
Basically, once you get below 10 degrees water temperature, there ain't a lot of moving happening.
So if you say summer period, it took you like 3 months to complete the study?
Yeah. Yeah, for the fieldwork component anyway.
Yeah. And then are you writing like little formulas and stuff? Does it already exist to figure out all these statistics, or do you have to like make it from scratch, or is it stuff that's already kind of there just because you do this that kind of work all the time?
Yeah, I mean, certainly the statistics for all that depletion, all the formulas for that are all there.
Yeah.
Working out all your averages and your confidence intervals and all that sort of thing. We had to come up with the experimental design to a degree, because nothing like this had been done elsewhere, really. But we did have a pretty good basis of literature to work from.
Yeah.
To help guide us here.
So, what did you see in the duck ponds? What did you find?
Lots of eels.
Yeah.
Like, it was quite
literally tons.
Yeah, it was quite crazy, really. Just the, I mean, some, to be fair, though, some ponds didn't actually have any eels in it, which is also an interesting result in itself. But by and large, most of them supported some eels. Some of them supported huge numbers. In fact, one really still sticks out in my memory, what we'd call one of those little dig-out jobs. Certainly a duck pond rather than a sort of more natural-looking wetland.
Yeah.
And it had over 100 eels in it.
And were they in good condition?
Oh, yeah, there's nothing wrong with them. Yeah, so very small wee pond and stacks of eels.
Is there something in your mind that you think, why did that specific one have more of a population than the other? Like, was there a better waterway? Was there more food? Like, is that not something you could pinpoint?
No. One thing I remember from that one was sinking into quite a bit of mud as going out and collecting the nets. And all I could really think of potentially is that there was a huge amount of anoxic muds in there producing perfect conditions for coronamids, which are...
What is that?
That's a little small midge larvae, red in coloration, and important food for eels, and it could have just been that there was just that much tucker
to support
those eels. Because the fact of the matter is, if there wasn't sufficient amount of food there, they'd either start out-competing each other, or they potentially would even start eating each other as well.
Yeah. Are they cannibalistic?
They are cannibalistic.
Okay. And is it just bigger ones preying on smaller ones?
Yeah, basically once they reach 700 millimetres in length, they really start to become more piscivorous, meaning they'll eat more fish in their diet.
Yeah.
And, their buddies will start looking good to them.
I think I told you, but I've seen like a couple of videos where this one fly fishing guide I follow on YouTube, where he's like, the moment he's got a trout on, there would be some massive eel darting out and like hitting that. Like, obviously it knows that fish is in distress in some way and is vulnerable, and it goes for it. So I mean, now you've done the study, it's taken you 3 months, you've extrapolated all the data. Oh, sorry, one thing I forgot. There was like a formula you used to determine how many nets you have to place per pond size. How did that work? Like, Yeah.
So basically, we had to make sure that the fishing effort was comparable amongst the different ponds, because of course we've got some small ponds,
yeah,
and we've got some monstrous ones. When we did have the really big ones, we did full depletion surveys in those, because it's, yeah, they're pretty special and unique, and the catch characteristics of that particular sort of wetland. But yeah, for those normal size sort of wetlands that we were dealing with, we just had a, I think it was something like one pond per 600 square meters or something, one net rather, per 600 square meters. So we could work out, based on the area of the pond, how many nets we needed to put in to keep that, capture efficiency, I suppose, comparable amongst the different wetlands.
How do you measure a pond from satellite image?
Yeah, satellite image is the easiest way to do that.
Yeah. And then you're just like, okay, so now you've done it, and what did you find? Like, how many eels are there in duck ponds?
Yeah, so it varied quite a bit. If I remember off the top of my head, it was, I think on average, it was around 22 shortfin eels per wetland, and can't actually remember what the long one might have been, 28, I think, long fin eels, something like that. Again, quite variable, ranging from zero through to around about one of those big wetlands had 300 odd eels in it. So yeah, it's quite a range, so quite variable. But yeah.
And then tonnage wise, I mean, there were, like, when you extrapolate that,
yeah,
that was like,
when we did the tons, it was 75,000 tons when you consider collectively all the 75,000 kilos. Sorry.
Kilos, yeah. And I mean, what does that say to you about, like, importance of duck ponds?
Yeah, no, it goes to show that habitat's certainly important, particularly when you consider that one of the main reasons why eels are in sort of, well, particularly longfin eels are in a bit of dire straits, really, is because of, you know, habitat loss, that being wetland habitat loss. We've also got stream channelization, which has been a major problem in particularly Southland, where they've straightened streams and lost all the meander, so we've lost huge amounts of habitat there as well. So basically this is a extra bit of habitat that they wouldn't otherwise have if it weren't for the hunters putting in that effort to create those duck ponds.
You don't like to call them duck ponds. Like, what, why, and like, what do you like to say?
Yeah, I suppose duck pond, it's an affectionate name, and that's what all the hunters will call them.
Yeah.
But I don't think it really gives them the credit that they deserve.
Yeah.
Because the fact of the matter is, they are open water wetlands, constructed open water wetlands. They're created by hunters.
Yeah.
And they don't just create habitat for ducks, as a duck pond would imply.
Obviously,
we've been able to show that eels certainly like them. And one of the other things that we found as we were going about was that we didn't just catch eels in some of these ponds. We caught other native fish as well, like giant cockapoo, for example, which is one of our native galaxids, some juvenile galaxids, some e-nunga, which are a whitebait species, and then other just ones like our common bully as well. Which is sort of, for the international listeners, that would be the likes of a wee sculpin, for example.
How are these ponds built? Is it like a stream running there already? Like, just like, how, when you have to advise someone to build a pond, like, what do you look for before it's built? Like, what needs to be there?
Yeah, well, there can be all sorts, really. I mean, they might have a drain, for example, that they just think, right, I want to, you know, dam this up, create a duck pond, and in the same process try and trap some sediment to stop it going into the creek. They might have just a wet depression in their paddock that's been drained by tiles, for example, and they think, well, it's not very productive, I can't seem to get grass to grow on it, it's just I might as well, you know, put some wetland habitat in there, so just go in there and break a tile and let it fill up over time, sort of.
So would they build like a stop bank also to kind of
dam it up? And sometimes it could just be that there might be a seepage off a hill face or something. And, you know, if you create a bund around that, you could, you know.
So what is a bund? Is it just like barriers around it? Or like,
yeah, sort of like a dam face, really.
Yeah. Are those like rock piles or like what?
No, it's normally made out of the soil that would be scraped from the site, from a dozer.
And then so those eel were present there already, or would they like sense in some way that there's a new, like, because they move a lot, like, how do the eel get there?
So I mean, in some instances, some of those drains that would be create a wetland around them, for example. Yeah. I mean, it's going to be, there'll be some eels present already in there.
Yeah.
But I think, by and large, they're finding their way to them. They can, for example, travel up those drains and through the overflow.
So a drain is a physical pipe that's put in to drain water away from a ship.
Open drains.
Yeah. Okay.
So, you know, they might do it for drainage work to drain the paddock.
Yeah.
Drain it into a creek, for example, so it creates passage into that drain. Then there would, of course, be tile drains, which are underground and designed to take the south and rain off the paddocks.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, that would be another way by just, breaking those in an appropriate spot. And, yeah, like I said just before, with the seepage as well, just capturing that water and being able to, make that open water.
And then another thing, as far as I understand, this is also has like it captures like sediment. So do farmers also put it in to, so if I talk about sediment, are we talking about nitrate runoff or like what do we talk about?
Sediment is a stressor in itself.
Yeah.
Because sediment, what it does is it clogs up the interstitial spaces, which is the gaps between the rocks and the streams.
Yeah.
And smothers it and basically reduces the amount of habitat available for invertebrates. So it's a very important stressor itself. But also phosphorus, which can encourage algal blooms.
Fertilizer or just naturally?
That's from fertilizers use. Yep. Phosphorus binds to that sediment as well. So it's particularly bad stressor.
Sediment. So how does that run off? Is it paddock that gets rain and it flows, like, is that basically what happens?
That would be it. Yep. Overland flow might be a cropped paddock, for example. And when it rains, muddy water, and that mud of horses, that muddy water's got fine sediment in it, and that makes its way into those ponds. And that was actually one of the real eye openers for me, like I touched on it just before, about my, it being up to my thighs and sediment as I'm going out to fetch these nets. They fill up with sediment. There's no doubt about it. They do a good job there.
Okay, so if you say they do a good job, they're filling up and there's like all these plants are like kind of making it healthier. Like, how does that work?
Yeah, so the pond itself capturing the sediment is good, and that the sediment doesn't make its way into
streams. Okay, cool, yeah.
Yeah, and then of course there's a lot of biological processes going on in there. Bacteria breaking down nitrogen, denitrification, that sort of thing, as well as vegetation rots in that system. So they are important for all sorts of things, both nutrient capture and sediment capture as well.
Okay, and then in future that's going to become important, probably just because farmers have to show that they're doing that.
Yep, so we're only going to get more and more of these duck ponds, aka hunter created wetlands, aka a sediment traps put in.
Well, that can only be a good thing.
Yeah.
So is this the kind of work that like keeps you at Fishing Game? Like, do you like going out into a field and doing, is this like
keeps you? I'm not actually involved too much in wetland design and construction and that sort of thing. It's more some of my colleagues, but it's a great thing that Fishing Game does.
Yeah.
Because it's very hands-on, on the ground, working with landowners and farmers and hunters.
Yeah.
And you certainly see the fruits of your labor when you've got a nice big hunter created wetland at the end of it.
Yeah. And then you can got the report to show like actually what the benefits are.
Oh,
so what is your day to day, or like what's your main thing at Fishing Game?
Oh, it's one of the good things about it. Fishing Game, it is pretty varied. So
yeah,
I can be out doing some research one day out in the field, doing monitoring, doing some lots of drift diving, or be doing, I recently did some swan counts when we counted out some black swans. So a good bit of field work, but then also some office-based stuff as well. Writing up that research or those monitoring and reports and that sort of thing.
Okay.
So it takes up quite a bit of my time.
So did I not ask anything about this study? Is there something that's relevant that I forgot to like touch on?
No, I think we've covered everything pretty good. I think the key thing that this study really highlights is that, hunters put a huge amount of effort into their wetland habitat creation to hunt an introduced game bird.
Yeah.
And in the process, what we've got is huge amounts of benefits for the environment, and of course, as we've been able to show, some native fish species along finial and the short finial.
Yeah. So what question, other questions does this study raise? Are you going to like, is there another study like kind of coming out of this that, or possible, or just things that you're curious about?
Yeah, I guess one thing that could be looked at is, of course, we've only been pretty narrow focused with longfin and shortfin eel with these hunter-created wetlands, but as I just alluded to there, there are all sorts of other species that can be using these. So like a full biodiversity assessment of wetlands that hunters have created across Southland would be another really interesting one, using the likes of eDNA
to see
what exactly is there. Because like, for example, it could be that our native bittern, which is an endangered bird, could actually be using some of these, hunter-created wetlands. They have been known to show up in constructed wetlands from time to time around the region. So it'd be interesting if we could detect them at various places, but also just other birds as well would be an interesting one. And I guess the thing is, hunters put a lot of effort into vegetating those areas as well, a lot of time with native vegetation as well. So that would be another one to see what a hunter's putting next to their wetlands and ponds, what else is living in their native species and introduced species.
Would you have a DNA reference for bittern? Like, could you just go and there's a frame reference?
They have got one now, yeah.
And how much does that cost to do?
To do an eDNA water sample is probably going to cost you in the vicinity of $250 to $300 sample.
Okay, so it's not like $2,000, but it's still a bit.
Yeah, and that's it, right. And of course, the more samples you do at a site, the more likelihood you're going to have of detecting.
Yeah, you're not going to take one sample and know it. You're going to have to.
Yeah.
Have you put up like trail cams? Like the Americans are heavy into their trail cams. Have you kind of put that up to see what lands there, or not really?
No, we haven't really done anything like that too much. We have used trail cameras to look at duckling use of different ponds and try and figure out those variables that are most important in term for ducklings to be able to use that pond. No, not really to assess what's there as such and what's showing up.
Yeah. So what's next for you? Do you, like, you've been fishing and hunting and stuff your like whole life, it sounds like. Do you still have like a hunting or a fishing goal that you're working to, like, I want to get a chamois this year, which I haven't, like, I've seen them and then I'm too far away or I don't have my rifle.
Do you have
like, okay, by December I want to hit something specifically, or?
Yeah, well, I was thinking as New Year's resolutions came up, as they often do at New Year's time, I thought I'd like to guide at least 3 people to shoot a deer over my dog.
Oh, awesome.
Who haven't shot a deer either before.
I volunteer, man.
Yeah, so that'd be a pretty cool one.
How old is your dog?
She's 6 years old.
And would you say she's like fully trained now?
Oh, she's fully trained.
And how long did that take?
I took her for her first hunt. I think she was at 16 months, and it probably took her 2 or 3 months before we got one. She started, putting 2 and 2 together. But of course, I went through an intensive training program before that to make sure that she was ready to go before we got in there. Didn't want headaches before we started. But she's basically in her prime at the moment. That's pretty awesome.
Do you do 1 dog or 2 dogs?
Just the one.
Okay, the one. And then you can take it to all properties, or there's like certain areas that's allowed, right?
Most public conservation land in Southland permit dogs, as long as it's not a national park.
Yeah,
they're all right.
And is she switched on? Like, if you go into a forest now, does she know why you're there?
Yeah, let's just say I don't often come back from hunting without a heavy pack anymore.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So how much do you think it's pushed up your success rate?
Oh, it's hard to describe. It's basically now a given that I'll be coming home with meat. But before I had a dog, it was probably, I had to do those early morning hunts, Now if I've got a dog, I just go out in the middle of the day if I wanted to. She's gonna smell it. So, I might have been lucky to get one out of every 2 trips before I had my dog. And then, now it's every trip or 2 a trip.
Now if they're bedded, it's fine because you'll find them.
Yeah, I've shot a few sleeping deer now.
And then how far away from them does she point usually?
She'll normally start her creep probably about 150 meters out.
Oh, okay, that's quite far.
Yeah, quite far. Yeah, so it depends on how the wind strength's like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you have to be pretty switched on to actually like spot the deer, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's a matter of who sees who first.
Man, that yeah. sounds super exciting. I'd dig to to do that.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's a cool goal to have.
Yeah.
It's nice to have like outdoor goals. Like I think I texted my wife this morning or yesterday. I'm like, chamois by the time I'm 45. So I turned 45 in June.
Yep.
So it gives me a decent window, and I've got two spots that I go to where I see them. And semi-easy access, it's all about the time, really, isn't it? Mm. You have to put the time in, otherwise exactly you're... Right. Yeah.
You're not going to get a chamois sitting at home on the couch.
No, you're not, and watching YouTube videos about it.
Yeah, that's right.
Man, cool. Man, that was awesome. I dig the work you guys are doing, and it's pretty exciting hearing about hunting over dogs.
Mm.
It's just a whole other ball game that I've been reading about a lot, but it's just, you know... We've got a dog that's now 10, and she's kind of getting... I've walked over 4,000 kilometers with her.
Mm-hmm.
So I started tracking it quite a few years ago. And I feel like I've done her injustice by not like... it's like a terrier, not allowing her to be a ratter or something, because she's caught a few rabbits, you know? And then, I think you really give an animal a good life if they're a working animal.
Oh, 100%.
Because I assume she likes it, right?
Oh, yeah.
That's cool. Cool, man. Awesome. Thanks. Excellent. I'm sure we'll talk again in the future.
Cool.
Good stuff.